0818-715-815.
And you are very welcome to Liveline. Katie Hannon with you until 3 o'clock today. You were listening to Dr. Ciarán Hickey there talking to Gavin on the news at one. You can't get away from it these last few days. It is scorchio all across southern Europe. And a lot of Irish holidaymakers and people from this side of Europe, I think, really struggling with those temperatures on their holidays. David, good afternoon to you.
Hi, Katie. How are you?
Now, I was expressing some sympathy for people who find themselves in this position yesterday. But you would it be fair to say your sympathy is limited or qualified?
I'd say it's qualified. I'd say I fundamentally have sympathy with anyone who is ill or infirm or young or old who finds themselves struggling with severe heat in a situation where they're looking forward to. And they find themselves struggling health-wise or mentally or physically. That's terrible. What my concern is that the information that's available that we've been getting for years now has told you that the world itself is heating irrevocably, and that particularly places that Irish people and English people, etc., tend to go on holidays are experiencing that to a more serious degree. And that people can exercise a sort of cognitive dissonance or ignore that fact and still travel to these places concerns me. And for two reasons. Number one, and I say this as somebody who has taken a flight here from Scandinavia, I take one flight a year to come and visit my mum, that flying is the worst possible mode of travel for the climate. And secondly, to travel to countries who are experiencing the most severe exigencies of the climate crisis, drought, wildfires, food shortages, etc., associated with those things, I can't personally get past the idea that I would be holidaying in somewhere and using the resources of people under immense climatic pressure. That's where my sympathy for ends there,
okay.
I guess.
Fair enough. But just let's just pick over that to some degree. I mean, if you're talking about the Costa del whatever, Costa del Brava, Costa del Sol, They are not at this point in time. I mean, if you're flying out there and having, pizzas with your family in the evening, we're not talking about an economy that is at this moment in time struggling to produce food, are we?
I actually believe that you are. I believe that if you go into any shops, you're now, and also I don't have the exact economics, but inflation is not just the price of things is affected by climate. Trust me, all the fruits and things, go into your food shops and see what you buy, where it comes from. It comes from those climate affected economies, and those people, unfortunately, they're in an invidious situation, like people in agriculture, where their financial stability is dependent on an industry that is fundamentally unsustainable. People traveling to the Costa del whatever, it's not possible to travel there the way we travel sustainably. There's no such thing as a free lunch. And my concern is that I don't feel as if people connect what we're being told in the news to their behavior. And whether those people are feeling it economically now, trust me, next summer, people will be thinking very, very, very differently about going to Costa del happy fun time, whatever you want to call it. It's a ticking clock, right? And those people's livelihoods are literally about to be massively impacted by this, by this summer. And where are those people going to start coming? They're going to start coming to places that have equitable temperatures, like Ireland. And then our resources then will be subject to larger and larger influx of tourists. And I'm curious how we're going to feel about that.
In terms of the economies of the places we're talking about, and we are talking about, as you say, the very, very popular tourist spots, Spain, Italy, Greece, the places that are now, burning up into the high 30s and mid 40s even in some places. Like, their entire economies are based around people like us going there for the week or two every year.
Yeah,
I mean, that's the first economic hit that's going to come their way, surely.
That's unfortunately a deal with the devil. in that, and it's the same a bit with agriculture, that the agricultural reliance on a way of farming, for example, that is climatically impactful, it's very hard to get out of that. Similarly, it's very hard to get out from working in, I'm not saying tourism as a whole is unsustainable, but that method of travel, the products we use, the things we buy, the air conditioning, the travel, all that sort of stuff is inherently, I'm sorry to say it, I love a holiday, don't get me wrong. I love a holiday, but it's fundamentally unsustainable. And the existential crisis here is not the tourism economy in these locations is going to take a dip. That's temporary. That's fundamentally temporary. Industries come and industries go. I qualified as a journalist myself. The journalism industry is it. I never ended up getting into it because that industry was on the wane. Industries come and industries go. What we can't let go is a livable planet. That's the existential crisis. That's the bigger picture. And I accept, trust me, I get anxiety thinking about it. It's terrifying. But that's what people need to start maybe reflecting on when they're making their decisions about it. There's no such thing as a free lunch. Unfortunately.
Are you saying, David, that we just need to absolutely rule out, forget? I mean, you say you come home, you fly from Scandinavia.
Yep.
From where in Scandinavia?
Yep. Norway.
Norway. Okay, so you have an annual you flight home. There is, I suppose there isn't a particularly easy route to come from Norway to Ireland.
My mother travels without flying back and forth, but I do not yet. We have a small daughter. What I would say, yeah, but anyway, sorry, you're asking a question.
Okay, my question is, like, how far do we need to go in your view in this now? Because, I mean, there'll be people out there, they don't fly. You know, some people do fly a lot, obviously, and there's maybe question marks over those life choices. But a lot of people have this just one return flight, a couple of hours to, you know, a holiday resort with their families once a year. They save up for it. They look forward to it. It keeps them going through the cold months of the winter. Are you saying that needs to go now?
No, I think it's a good point. That's nuanced. And the point you reference is that actually business travel and business class travel are vastly, 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 vastly more damaging in the frequency of business travel. And also if you're traveling in a business class seat in a plane, you're taking up more space, your actual carbon emissions are more per person. And secondly, I think something like only maybe 10, 20% of people at less than that will ever use a plane in their life. So, you know, Mary and Joe, who take their 2 weeks of Mallorca every year, this isn't necessarily about them, but it is as well. Because number one, it's about signaling that we sort of individually need to be leaders in this and saying, okay, I know I could do this, but I also know that I'm not entitled, none of us are entitled to this sunny summer holiday. But the point being that my secondary point, flying is one thing, and I try and do as little as humanly possible. Secondly, my concern is that we're looking at these countries, Spain, Italy, France, Greece, we're looking at them starting in March and April. That's when wildfire season and drought season starts. Uruguay, I know we're not all traveling to Uruguay. Uruguay has literally run out of tap water. And we're looking at these countries, we're looking at these things happening, whether we're noticing it or not or choosing to ignore it, they are under severe pressure. And those things lead to social unrest, they lead to movement of people, all that sort of stuff. Can you imagine wildfire and drought season starting in April? It's terrifying. And the idea that we're sort of happy enough to go there and spend our 2 weeks and have our holiday and sit in the pool and drink whatever, while ignoring the fact that these people, the people who live there, they're not on holidays. They have to live there all year. We can go and splash around and have fun. So that, for me, that sort of maybe a fundamental lack of empathy is what worries me a bit about where we're going, and that we can't think a little bit deeper about the choices that we make. And I encourage people to do that. And trust me, I'm new to this. I have not always thought that way. And I'm not saying I'm right, but I'm just saying that I think maybe we need to think a bit more about what we do and how those choices affect the places we're going.
What? Tell me about your mom. If you say she travels to see you and your family in Norway, but how does she get there if she's not flying?
She travels via ferry and trains throughout Central Europe.
How long does it take her?
takes her about 3 days. Now, what I would say is, you know, she sort of, there are a couple of gaps where she needs to grab a train, can be a bit hairy. You've got 10 minutes, the train is late, whatever. What she does do is she overnights at least once or twice on the way. She buys an Interrail ticket, but she manages to work broadly. She can work during that period. You said it yesterday. You said train travel is a godsend. It is. And now, okay, the Wi-Fi experience changes, but actually train travel on the continent, no offence to Irish trains, is very, very, very comfortable. Trains are wider, trains are bigger, Wi-Fi is better, they go faster, all that sort of good stuff. So it's not dead time for her, that journey, but it is not fast. It's about 3 days, sort of door to door.
Yeah, and you'll appreciate as well, of course, as you say, and you mentioned that you have a small child, travelling in that kind of a way with very small children can be very, very challenging.
Absolutely. There's balance here and there's nuance. I wouldn't do that. I wouldn't be able to do that now. Our child, she's three. She'd disown us if we took her for 3 days across land and sea, and she'd be right. But again, I have never, and I probably will never, go on a Mediterranean holiday with her. And primarily because I'm thinking that this decision is tangibly impacting her future. And I know that's a bit sort of, you know, woke or whatever the naysayers want to call it. But I realise that. And I can't get that out of my thinking when I decide where we go and what we do.
When you see what's happening, David, and I think a lot of people who maybe might have been sort of see no evil, hear no evil, and not really paying that much attention. I do think that the news headlines of not just this week and last week, but you know what we were hearing about the temperature of the sea and the effect that's having on coral and what, you know, just these unprecedented highs that we're hitting in terms of temperature around the world in recent months. Do you think it's actually cutting through a bit more than perhaps it ever has done?
I'll give you an analogy. I started losing my hair when I was about 23, which was very unfortunate. I've kept a bit, but suddenly I noticed everyone who was losing their hair. Before, I didn't care. Now, it's the same with climate. As soon as things started really happening tangibly, I cannot not see climate news. It's as if I'm myopically, when I open the Guardian website or the Irish Times or whatever, a tabloid newspaper, I'm everything else is a blur and I'm laser focused on the climate news. But now, climate news is front page. And I just don't think, we don't have a chance to turn away. The grim reality is, and I think sometimes scientists might tell you, we're actually too late. We're too late to really, really maintain the way we live now. This is changing and it's going to change. What we can do is adapt and maybe regroup a little bit. But I agree with you. I do think this could be the turning point. My only concern is that people will equate El Nino with the real reason for the spike and not necessarily say it's fossil fuel use, etc. That equivocation, I think, could be a bit damaging. But I hope you're right, and I really do.
But I mean, El Nino probably does have some impact in what we're seeing right now. Do we have to accept that as well? And I know people are grasping at straws to some degree to say, it's just for this couple of years of El Nino. You know, we'll be grand again at the end of that.
Yeah.
But in terms of,
but can I just say one thing?
Yeah.
Can I just to finish on that point? I understand people being, when you're afraid of something, you become defensive. I understand people thinking, it's whatever, it's all this sort of, it's Guardian / liberal media has an agenda around climate. I understand people reacting that way and being defensive and and rejecting the idea of climate change, but we just can't do that anymore. I'm terrified as well, but I'm accepting, and I think we just have to acknowledge the empirical realities a bit more.
Could I put you another idea? I think there might have been this idea in Ireland that climate change for Irish people might mean a little bit, you know, that we get a suntan here as we wouldn't have to go abroad, that it was actually going to just give us a little bit of a more sunnier climb. Do you think people look out at the rain we've had over the last number of days and actually realise that that's all part of the deal, really?
Yeah, very possibly. I mean, I think the heat on the ground generally means more humid. I, for the record, I failed every science exam I've ever taken in my entire life. My general understanding is that heat on the ground can mean more humidity in the air. And by God, has it been raining this summer? It does mean more of that. And there was a very well-written piece in the Irish Times, written in one of the suburbs of Dublin, where the journalist basically spoke to locals, and they were experiencing very serious flooding that they hadn't seen before. And a lot of them were starting to sort, they were turning a corner saying, this isn't normal, this is serious. and they were feeling the direct impacts of it. I remember when I was 19 and we had a really hot summer and I spent all my time out suntanning, thought it was great. I remember literally saying the words, bring on climate, bring on global warming, this is great, I have a tan for the first time in my life. It's not about that anymore. It really isn't. And it's not going to be us sitting out in our sunnies. People will literally have less food and less water and lots more flooding.
What do we do? I mean, in terms of changing people's attitudes towards air travel, I mean, to begin with, rather than go to the people and get them to change their attitudes, surely there should be a policy level, actions in terms of the free ride, if I can make the pun, that aviation gets in terms of the taxes and how we deal with aviation in, you know.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And look, look at the amount of bailouts aviation has had, not just during COVID. It's a fundamentally unsustainable business model. It's not a good business model. The amount of times it has to be bailed out around Europe alone is insane. I personally, so just as an example as well, we used to fly internally in Norway. But it's a 7-hour, 8-hour car journey, 6.5-hour train journey. We used to fly that journey. So 2 years ago, we stopped. We'll hop the train. Train takes 6.5 hours. Costs us about €400 for the three of us. But ultimately, that journey, door to door, is only about 2 hours more than if we'd flown. So that's a hop-on, hop-off journey. We have to change the train, but it's a glorious way to travel. It's a great way to travel. So my argument would be incentivize the daylight out of rail networks, at least. And Europe is doing this. Night trains are becoming even more popular. Interconnected railways. An interrail card will cost you about €300, and you can get so many trains as you like within reason in Europe. But also, France, for example, has basically banned internal flights. That's a major step. France is leading the way in a lot of cases.
Any flights less than, is it 2 hours?
I think you're right, by train.
You can no longer go get those by air. Will you hang on, David? I've got John on another line here. John, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Katie. How are you?
I'm good. What, you were listening to David there?
I did, yeah. And to be honest, you know, it was a cross between exasperation and keeping myself in check. He made the comment there about, you know, it's completely unsustainable, that method of travelling in the volume that we had, air transport and so forth. In his opinion, global emissions from air transport, global, is 2% of emitted emissions. 2%. So my first case will be, when you've dealt with the 98%, let's deal with the 2%. That's the first thing. The second thing is, we're an island. It's the predominant means of getting off the island is by air. And it's neither reasonable nor fair to expect people to give that up. Ironically, and just at the end of his comment there, he made the argument about train and rail. And I'd actually support train and rail. I have no problem with that at all. But Ireland isn't particularly well served domestically, internally, for it, unless you're within the pale of the M50, of course. The rest of us make do with the cars and getting to Dublin Airport to get out of the country when we need to. But ironically, I too have family in Norway. I have family in Bergen. Right? And they do have a fantastic approach to this stuff. But the irony is not lost to me that the largesse with which they do that, the subsidies for EV, they have an excess of hydroelectric power that they export, and their price of that domestically reflects that, is the largesse of the Norwegian economy is built on that since the 1960s, on oil and gas, which they sell to us. Right? Mm-hmm. So, in the global pantheon of emissions generally and what we can do for it, are we saying that we put ourselves to penury here, like the bailout type of effect, when the largest economies that have the greatest influence, the Americas, the Chinas, the BRICS countries, aren't going to make the effort? What is the benefit? Because the planet won't improve unless they do something. So what is the benefit of putting us and our people to suffering over it in the meantime? That's my point.
Okay. I let David back in on that, but this idea that there's no point in us doing anything because it's so small, like the drop in the ocean thing.
I don't say don't do anything, but there's got to be a balance here for the benefit of people. And there's no point in our economy being put under the cosh purely for, I don't know, I don't want to call it theory because it's a little bit more than that, but for an argument which we ultimately have very little influence in globally.
I think David's point is that we will be put under the cosh if we don't change our agenda. David, I'll let you respond yourself. I won't be putting words in your mouth.
Yeah. Yeah. Hi, John.
Hi.
I hope your family are not getting too much rain in Bergen. I know that's a rainy spot as well. I mean, John makes two points. Number one, that we shouldn't be stopped from. We're an island. We need to fight to get off the island. Obviously, that's not necessarily the case. Actually, you can take a ferry to the UK, and from the UK, you have literally some of the fastest trains in the European continent that will take you to Amsterdam, Paris, Belgium, etc. And the other point,
that's no benefit to me in Galway.
Well, actually, it is a benefit to you in Galway. Because it's a 2.5. Yeah, sorry, just my other point is. We are absolutely, one thing that maybe we've forgotten about ourselves, no one is entitled to a holiday. No one is entitled to fly on a holiday. It's not a human entitlement. We're not entitled to that. It's something we want and we expect. We're not entitled to that. We weren't given a God-given right to say, welcome to the world, enjoy your trip annually in Gran Canaria, have a great time. It's not an entitlement. It's something that societally has become normalized and we expect. We're not entitled.
But one group of people entitled to tell that other people they can't do it either.
They're two entirely different things. I'm not saying, and actually, I'm not telling anyone what to do. I'm commenting on a behaviour that I feel needs to change. But I can't tell anyone what to do. No question.
Can I ask
and
you,
for
John?
For the record,
finish. Yeah.
John's right and he's wrong. Air aviation contributes 2.5% to actual global emissions. 2.5% seems like a small number. In the scale of the amount of emissions, it's not a small number.
Right.
It's an absolutely massive number. Just because it's 2.5 of the 100% does not make it a sort of an irrelevant statistic.
I'd argue that then other 97.5% is going to be easier to make progress on. And should be prioritised.
No argument there. No argument. But the point being, though, that we're not here on a radio show talking about who should reduce their fossil fuel exploration or their emissions. That's not the topic of the day. No question. And for the record, I live in a country that is probably per capita one of the biggest emitters of global emissions. And trust me, that makes my heart sink. I think that's appalling. But that's not the issue at question right now. Just for the record, we're talking about behaviours in travel and behaviours of travel to massively, massively climate-affected countries that I can't reconcile the cognitive dissonance between someone travelling to a country where they know that those people have been experiencing drought and wildfires for at least the last 8 years on record.
John, can I ask you, John, are you worried about climate change?
Well, I am, because funnily enough, I'm actually in a business that's allied to making things more energy efficient in the first place. But I have a particularly practical, not that yours is impractical, but I'm coming from a particular nuts and bolts approach to doing it. And it's from building energy efficient buildings. That's what I do now.
John, you're plugged in, absolutely plugged in to this climate debate then, if that's your business.
I am, but the way I do it is I don't look at it from I must build this building such and such a way because of emissions that's driving me. What I'm doing is from just a fundamental make the building efficient perspective and keep people out of fuel poverty and make their life more comfortable. But I'm not prepared to sacrifice everything to do that. There's got to be moderation in all things. It's like people telling you, for the sake of argument, you know, you've probably heard this anecdotally that if you build a new house now, you can't have a fireplace. Well, that's not entirely true. You can't have certain types of fireplaces, but we have an anachronistic approach to them in Ireland that we like the feature thing on the wall, the far side of the room, and we want to look at it and switch it on or light it up. And there's no reason why you can't have, to a certain extent, your cake and eat it when you do that. But if I just before I forget it, I'm probably of an age older than, David, that I remember when I was in school, and whilst climatic and environmental wasn't as prevalent a concern then as it is now, it certainly did come up in school. And I remember being told, in the late 70s, on the cusp of the second oil crisis back then, that there was two things coming down the road to us. The first one was, the oil is all going to be gone by 2000.
Well, that was peak oil. That was the peak oil one.
Yeah, correct. And the second thing was, the next thing that's coming is the ice age. Look where we are.
Neither of those things have happened. You're not suggesting. Are you saying you don't accept what the scientists are saying is coming down the tracks in terms of climate change? Are you?
No. I don't accept that the causes are as definitively established yet as they should be. No, I don't.
What will it take to convince you if what's happening out there right now or has been happening over the last number of years has not convinced you? What do you want to see?
You're not trying to convince me. If everybody in Ireland tomorrow handed in their keys to their cars, we pulled all the buses off the road, we grounded all the planes, that's not going to rescue us, right? Because until everybody is on the same page, and the biggest contributors to the problems, like I mentioned earlier, until they are at least going some way down the road the same as us, then we're going to put ourselves at a societal and an economic disadvantage. And for what?
Well, to save the planet for our grandchildren, I think.
But we won't save the planet. That's my point. We will certainly make our effort and do our bit.
John, if you're waiting for everyone to jump, sure nobody will jump. I mean, if that's the point at which you accept we need to take action, we're always going to be at the starting point.
You can make your personal contribution through your personal choices, and that's good. And there's no downside to that. What I'm trying to say is that if you look at carbon taxes, for instance, in particular, the imposition on them, what has been the biggest effect on them? It's increasing the level of fuel poverty among those who can least afford it. But is carbon taxes going to drive down our consumption of energy? It isn't. Because if you look even within Ireland, our electricity consumption and our network is creaking. Why? Because the demand is up. Our transport emissions are back to pre or similar COVID levels as they were 3 years ago. You know, carbon taxes haven't mitigated them against that. And it's making people angry. And it'll make people rail against it rather than take on board the material thing that you're trying to achieve.
Well, I think to be fair to David, David's point is that we should incentivise rather than punish, I think. I think that was the point you were making.
Well, fair enough. I'm all for incentivising over punishing, but here we seem to have adopted the punishment first approach.
Okay, John.
That's unfortunate.
Okay. I'm going to have to take a break, John. Thanks for that. We'll be back. There's more people who want to come in on this after these.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Or text us on 51551. Can I bring in Joanne now? Joanne, good afternoon.
Hey, how are you?
You have been listening to our debate.
I have been, and I'm slightly mortified to admit that I've just come back from a flying holiday in Slovenia.
Yeah, well, you're not the only one, Joanne, to be fair.
But I wanted to say that one of the good things about going on holidays to other places is that you can actually learn things about how people do things in other countries that might actually be useful in terms of thinking about the climate and thinking about the future and thinking about what we could do differently.
And tell me, just before you get to that, when you were booking your flights to go to, is it Slovenia you said you were?
Yes.
Did you feel a pang of guilt as you booked those flights, or did it occur to you at all that actually maybe this isn't the way to be?
Of course I felt a pang of guilt. Yeah, don't we all? Most of us.
This is what I wonder, actually. Do people feel guilty now? Is this become a guilty pleasure, literally? Okay, so you went there. What did you see there that you thought, I need to think about this some more when we go home?
Well, I went there and I was kind of amazed because, like, it's a small country, but it's fairly densely populated. Like, it's more densely populated than Ireland. It's about 50% more densely populated. But the thing that amazed me is that 60% of the country is in forests. So you go around, like we went around on the bus and the train, and like literally everywhere is just trees as far as you can see. Again, in a country which has a much higher population density than we have. And the thing that you notice is that all the villages and the towns and the city, everything is kind of, you know, compact, so that you get to the edge and there's a proper edge, and right next to the edge, there's a forest. Whereas they don't have the kind of sprawl that goes on for miles and miles and miles, and you don't have, like, you know, what you would think would be farmland that has, like, kind of one-off housing everywhere and, like, estates that go on for miles and miles. And so it seems like they've really put a lot of thought into their planning and into making sure that they actually are adhering to the planning.
Good spatial planning, yeah.
Yeah, good spatial planning. And I was really struck by that because you know, it often seems here like it would be impossible to do some of these things. Like, it'd be impossible, you know, to have good planning. It's impossible to, you know, have more forests. It's impossible to, you know, kind of achieve our goals in terms of those sorts of things. But to see it actually working in a country that, you know, it's not like Slovenia is one of these super wealthy countries that, you know, for decades have been kind of at the top of the heap. I mean, they were, you know, they were like a former communist country.
Indeed,
they had all sorts of problems, you know, and narrowly escaped all the wars that they had over there. So, you know, if they can do it, like, surely we should be able to do it.
Okay, good one. Thank you, Joanne. It's a beautiful country, I have to say. Some years since I've been there now, but a very, very beautiful place. Can I bring in Beata? Beata?
Beata.
Mm-hmm. Beata. Mm-hmm. How are you, Beata?
Not too bad at all. I'm on my way to the dentist, actually, so that's why I'm a bit short for time.
You wanted to respond to what John was saying?
Yeah, I thought, you know, when I listened to his arguments there, this thing about all the others have to do things first and then we might actually come in there when it comes to climate change. I think it's one of those arguments that I've been hearing a lot from right-wing orientated people, in particular from parties that have sprung up now all over Europe over the last couple of months. And I think, you know, it's a really dangerous way to look at things. I think if we don't all understand and see what's happening around us, then we are really going into trouble. And there's no way of escaping the catastrophe that we're really getting into if we don't take responsibility, every single one of us.
Okay. I'm just, your line isn't great, Beata. I'm just going to let John respond to that very quickly. John, do I have you back there?
You do, yeah. Can you hear me? You
can? Yes, I can, yeah.
Yeah, hi, Katie.
Yeah.
Gruscott, Beata. I hear what you said, but maybe I didn't come across quickly. I didn't say we wait for everybody else to do it, but we are going to push ahead and be at the, it seems to me, be at the forefront of it, which ordinarily would be a good thing. But if there's nobody actually following us behind, then we're just making martyrs out of ourselves.
But hang on a second. John. How do you know nobody? So how can you make the case that nobody's following on behind? Or even that we are at the front? I mean, there is no suggestion that we are at the front of anything in this, to be honest. So we were laggards. Wasn't that the famous line that the minister admitted we were in terms of our climate policies?
No, sorry. First of all, that's Eamon Ryan speaking. So that's, I take that with a pinch of salt.
I think that was Richard Bruton, actually, when he was the minister.
Well, yesterday I read for the first time, I thought it was actually a wind-up, I thought it was fake news, and I had to go and Google it somewhere, it turned out to be correct. Sweden, Norway's neighbour, has now abandoned the net zero approach and the zero emissions approach to everything. The government has thrown it out, and they said, we're going to go back to neutral. Germany, which I assume is where Beata comes, turned off their nuclear there in the last couple of years and has gone back to coal mining, which has been exacerbated by the Ukrainian situation, and they're over-reliant on imported gas. Now, they're not planned events. They're events that occurred and they've had to deal with it. You know, no more than your last contributor mentioned about the spatial awareness and the planning. I live in one of those one-off houses, as you call it, in the countryside. And one of the reasons why they seem sprawled as they do, it was, possibly not so much anymore, but it was for 40 or 50 years, official planning policy that you must have a minimum width on a site of 100 feet, 30 metres. So ergo, the next house cannot be more than, like, any closer than 100 feet and 100 feet and 100 feet. So that's not the people electing to do that. That's actually policy. Was misinformed. And now you try to go the other direction And you'll get another excuse, like you look at the struggles trying to increase the density of high-rise buildings in Dublin and the pushback on that.
Did you see the movie Don't Look Up, Jan?
I did.
What did you think?
Not recently now, so you'd be stretching my memory a little bit. Yeah.
But I mean, you know, the concept is fairly straightforward. There's this massive meteor heading for Earth and everyone is talking about everything but the disaster that is on its way.
Yeah.
Did that, you know, resonate with you in any way in terms of how we are responding to...
I'll tell you what it is. I actually found it, and again, it wasn't recently, it reminds me of the feeling of angst. And I was mentioned earlier from school about the way we were told the world was going to turn out and the way things were going then. And you're telling that to school children. I found a similar sort of emotional response to that, you know. And of course, this is the nature of getting older. You hopefully get a better perspective, and you get a bit of depth to your thinking, rather than it being as shallow as it is in a child. And that's why I think the way I know that there isn't going to be a simple black and white answer. There isn't going to be a simple black and white approach. And the stick over the carrot approach, in particular, is not helpful.
I'm going to bring in, thank you, John. Thank you.
Appreciate that, John.
Thank you. Patricia, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. How are you?
I'm good.
Good. I think that chap that's on there, and everybody's now entitled to their own opinion, but he's very negative towards, you know, organising things, going places, going here, going there. My son works in Sweden and it has never been a problem over there. They just get on with it. And I think, you know, this scaremongering and whatever. I think that chap should just buy a camper and camp around Ireland. You know, he's not even willing to try things, to do things, whatever. We have to get on. We have to live with what we're thrown at. I don't believe in all this ozone. I believe, actually, yesterday the world was supposed to end, they said. You know, and we're getting all these negative approaches. We'll all turn into very negative people, you know.
But do you not think there is a good reason? I mean, you're calling it scaremongering, but I mean, there is good reason to be, I'll use the softest word I can think of, concerned about. As records go, we have never seen anything like the temperatures. We've never seen anything like the rainfall levels. We've never seen anything like what's happening in our seas.
We had a place in Portugal, sorry to cut across, we bought it about 20 years ago. I remember we'd leave here in the cool, we'd go over there and it was so damn hot. We took it for granted. We were going to Spain to get the heat. We were going here. We came back here to hail rain. I could remember nearly getting pneumonia coming to show my tan off here at winter, you know, after being over abroad. And I can't see any, you know, they're taking things off us like, you know, we can't have turf anymore, we can't have anything anymore, we can't have this. Do you not think that, you know, it's been a little bit negative about things? And if that guy is saying we're already in the middle of it, like, you know, we didn't have those thoughts years ago in the middle of that. It was just, my mother-in-law went to Tunisia when it was, I'd say 1960, whatever, and the heat was so stifling, people were still dying. When I was in Portugal with the heat, we lost people.
I know, Patricia, but Patricia, Patricia, yeah. I have to tell you that we're not talking about once-off heat waves or the difference between there and here and that time that your mother-in-law went to Tunisia. I'm sure it was very hot. But what I'm saying is that the records, the scientists, the people who measure these things are telling us it has never, ever, ever, ever been as hot as it is now, as recent temperatures, that we have breached any sort of record that has ever been made before. And I'm saying to you, should we not be a bit worried about that?
Look, you know, you can be worried, It's like we were washing our hands during COVID. We got used to doing it because that's what we were doing. We were given injections. We were given this, that and the other. Yet it didn't stop people dying. They can't, like that guy was saying about Sweden and you can't park your house here and you can't do this, that and the other. They have gone on to do it all back again and they've no problems. Even the COVID wasn't as bad over there. Now, I live in Bettystown here and you cannot put your house any further out the gate than the person next to you. We're all single houses. But you can't put, you know, extra a roof on this, that and the other. I mean, this has happened. Do you not think it's the evolution of the world, you know, whatever, and that we're all going to burn to death if we do these things that were after you?
I don't... Patricia,
there's a negativeness there.
I'm afraid now I'm going to side with the scientists on this one, Patricia.
I'm not being negative. A scientist, you know. But do you not honestly think that there's a negativeness about this man not bringing children abroad, not going this abroad, not going that abroad? I think he would have maybe a negative approach in a lot of things where, look at...
You can't be saying somebody would have a negative approach in a lot of things when they're making very, very promising or very proactive arguments about things that need to be done about something that David feels is... a very urgent global crisis.
Patricia, but they're scaring mongers and they're making people feel more negative. I have people now that I have clients that, you know, we get on and we're clean, we're tidy, we empty the bin, we this, that and the other. I wouldn't throw anything in the sea, I shouldn't, whatever. But people are just now scared, sick, that they're not going swimming. They won't go abroad. They're afraid. I mean, look at the way we helped, you know, Ukraine in that. We've helped the people. We've brought them along. Thank God we've a lot living here. They're fab. They're lush, you know. And like, okay, you can have a little bit of luck. Let's just maybe. But do you not think telling us we can't burn coal, we can't do turf, we can't do this, we can't do that. There are two people causing a war in Ukraine.
Okay. We're going a bit off topic, but I think one of the points I'll take from that, though, is what David was saying, that if we are worried about our refugee situation right now, that it'll be nothing to what we will see once we start getting climate refugees. First of all, I think from Africa, and then David is saying there'll be people from Greece and Italy and Spain arriving on our doorstep, saying they can't leave where they are.
Why did I buy Portugal? I bought Portugal to get away from the bloody rain and the deepness and the whatever. And we, you know, the sunshine is so beautiful. It was lovely to have both.
Okay.
Holiday, do you get me there on that one? I do.
Patricia.
My husband's sister comes home from Australia. You know, she finds it so dark and dismal here. And like, I rang her there and they're in winter at the minute. Their winter is 25 degrees, you know?
Patricia, I have people lining up to get on. Thank you very, very much. Take care of yourselves out there in Bettystown. Can I bring in Joan? Joan, good afternoon.
Hi, Katie. How are you? I just like to say I actually completely agree with everything David, the first caller, said.
Okay, you know, bit of support for David.
100%. I didn't find him remotely negative. I found him actually very positive. But I would just like to add to that we really need to look at what we're eating, you know. There's a great book by a guy called George Monbiot, and he says, you know, feed the world without devouring the planet, because that's currently what we are doing. We're devouring the planet. So the impact people can make by, you know, changing the sources of our foods, even slightly altering our diets, so that, you know, we haven't got so much land being taken up for beef and dairy. You know, it's so damaging, you know. And that last lady mentioned COVID and the pandemic, you know, and you know, environmental changes are small changes in comparison, you know. But we need political will to do it. I really feel the government should be doing more. It's an environmental crisis. It's a threat to humanity. There's no question about it. And we need to respond to it. And you know, we can't just keep going like we are when greenhouse gas emissions from dairy in this country is at 40%. You know, it's crazy.
You're a vegan yourself, are you, Joan?
I'm not saying people need to be vegan. I'm saying even slightly altering your diets. You know, I think organic agriculture, maybe growing food that's cheap, healthy. You know, there needs to be a change. There really does. Like,
David, you want to just very quickly? I'm going to take a break, but you want to just very quickly respond there.
Yeah, I'd love to hear more from Patricia, by the way, if we get more time. But just to answer Joan, the point being that this stuff, these changes, they're really annoying. They're really, really, really annoying because we all love the things that are ultimately bad for us and bad for the environment and the climate. It's a pain. I hate them myself. Cheeseburgers, holidays in the sun, all this. I love those things. And I hate not being able to do them. And I hate that they're damaging. They're not always nice decisions, but they are decisions that actually, as Jonas pointing out, will be loads better for us. But it's a pain to make them. Okay. But they will be tricky and difficult.
Okay.
I'm actually agreeing with you. It was the previous caller.
I think he was making that point, Joan. I'm going to have to take another break. Hang on. We have another few minutes on this after that.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
I want to bring in Tony now. Tony, good afternoon.
How you doing, Katie?
I'm good, Tony. How are you?
I'm very well. Very interesting discussion. A couple of quick points, Katie. Both David and I think Michael or John made excellent contributions, but you have to understand the big picture. First of all, what can you do as an individual? As an individual, you can do certain things within your budget or within the support in the government. So I took out all our oil heating almost 20 years ago. I'm a second generation of solar generation at the moment, so I take nothing from the grid. I pretty much give to the grid. I have geothermal. Our house is a 1970s house, but it's an A rating house. But that, actually, I spent about 20 years getting it up to spec. When we talk about governments, our government doesn't do enough. Most governments don't do enough. We could quite easily grant aid most of the people in this country to put in solar or geothermal. We don't. We could also do the same for electric cars. I will be taking delivery of an electric car this week, but they're expensive. So I forego other things to do that. I also grow a lot of my own food. But however, to say that the farmers of Ireland should cut back production, that's not a simple zero-sum game. We supply about 40 to 50 million people in the world with food at a very low carbon footprint. Now, we can cut that all back. And if we do that, that will move to the southern hemisphere at 3 and 4 times the carbon footprint. That is not a sensible approach. So we need our government, and we have Greens in our government, to take real action to support individuals to make good decisions to reduce their carbon footprint. We also need to help our industry to do the same. But beating our farmers up about dairy and beef, if we shut them all down tomorrow, we would make the situation worse. So we need some joined up thinking and some sensible thinking.
And tell me about Tony, I'm just intrigued. Like 20 years ago, you were very much ahead of the posse there, switching over, getting off the grid.
I did electronic engineering 40 years ago. On the first time I saw a solar cell the size of my fingernail, I couldn't believe it. So I had my house built, orientated for solar panels, and the local county council asked me why my house was in a different direction than everybody else's. And it took me 20 years later to put in solar panels.
And
because they didn't exist then.
And I mean, I'm sure over the recent year and everybody else, you know, petrified of the bill coming in the door, You must
bill
have
is
felt...
very small for the electricity. It's actually zero. It's minus. I get money from the grid.
I was going to say, are you able to sell it back to the grid at this stage? Yeah.
Yes, and that's another sore point. I sell it back at about half the price that I pay for a unit of electricity. And in one single stroke of a pen, the government could make the suppliers pay domestic users what they actually charge them. And they could also support our farmers, put them on their outbuildings and supply 1 million homes. We don't do that. And these would not cost anything like the oil and the hydrocarbons that we import from Saudi Arabia, etc.
Have we not? I thought we'd made more progress with that, because I know that the IFA and others have been campaigning, and a lot of people campaigning for this
they
whole micro-generation.
Yeah. But the reality is, you actually must have an incentive. And we are not incentivizing our farmers enough. The farmers would do it if they got a better incentive. And there's no point in kicking the farmers. Why would you pay a Saudi billionaire for oil if you can pay the local farmer to put up solar panels that will then reduce your carbon footprint and your import of oil, which would also improve your circular economy?
I know.
I'd love to talk to Eamon Ryan and ask him some hard questions, because he doesn't understand the economics of the environmental changes that we need to make.
Okay, Tony.
Okay, I've met him a couple of times.
Tony, we'll talk again, because you obviously...
Pleasure always, Katie.
Always, Tony. Thank you very much. Helen, just before we leave this. Helen, good afternoon.
Oh, good afternoon. How are you, Katie? Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you, yeah. Thank you. And you would be agreeing with Tony and David there, would you?
I would, very much so. Yes, when I heard David coming on, I really think he made his points very clearly, very cogently. He's expressing something that is, you know, we're on a cliff edge here, and he's absolutely correct about the what we're looking at. Really, I don't think we're maybe ready to look at it. I do understand that change is very, very difficult. It's like our whole Western society has been set up to, you know, kind of do the kind of practices that we're doing. We have an awful lot of disposable and throwaway. Just yesterday, there was a surgeon on talking about the waste in the medical world in terms of, you know, one-off disposable equipment and protective gear. And that has all obviously come about since the COVID epidemic as well. But we haven't gone back to, you know, a more renewable form of that. But just to his point about going to the hot countries and the extreme heat that they're suffering, you know, this isn't what it was 20 years ago. And, you know, I know some people were kind of acting as if this is nothing new, but this is something new. It's very much something new. But it's been going on for nearly 10 years now. We've had these extreme heat waves and sort of emergency situations, but they haven't lasted for long enough for, I guess, you know, a serious change to happen. But they're happening in the countries that Irish people like to go to on their holidays, of course. So that's why I suppose
we're finally tuning in, indeed. I think we are
Well, yes. And I mean, obviously, there's probably families over there right now, and it's no fun. It's just no fun if you've got small children, especially. But for everyone, it's deeply uncomfortable to be in those kind of temperatures. So you can't have the type of holiday that you probably envisaged having. You know, it's changed. And this could be the way it's going to be, because once, you know, that kind of heating up goes on, and those countries, they're the countries having severe droughts as well.
Okay.
So you're getting an increase in the heat in the earth, and, you know, and we're getting the opposite, I know, but there's kind of a link there too, I believe, in terms of us getting a lot of rainfall and them getting none. So, you know, it's something has to change.
Okay. Helen, I think David was making exactly that point, actually, that it is all linked, and that, as he says, we must change our attitude or it will just get worse and worse. Helen, thanks for that. David, thank you. We'll take a break.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Joe Duffy!
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Now, we're going to leave that there because I want to bring you back to Ciara Mangan. Mayo woman Ciara Mangan, of course, endured what was a truly horrific ordeal when she was raped by a colleague 10 years ago and then shamed and taunted about it by her colleagues. And yesterday her rapist, Shane Noonan, received a 7-year prison sentence. But it was Ciara's bravery and her resilience and her powerful statement and her interview with Orla O'Donnell on This Morning today that has made really a huge impact, I think, on the country. And she explained that she decided to come forward and waive her right to anonymity to give someone out there the courage that maybe they need as well. She says, just to show that justice is possible and I'm still here. And she also spoke about how much respect she had for the other victims of sexual violence that came before her and waived their anonymity. Well, the first survivor of rape who made legal history when she came forward and waived her right to anonymity was, of course, Lavinia Corwick. And Lavinia is on the line now. Lavinia, you're very welcome.
Oh, hi, Katie. Thank you.
Lavinia, I actually can't believe, because I still very, very clearly remember that interview you did with Gerry Ryan. I can't believe it's 31 years ago.
I know. Can you believe it? On the 16th of July, that was Sunday, just gone. And it's like yesterday, really, because you go back to that day and you kind of moment by moment go through it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's amazing to me because obviously a lot of people still remember it. You know, it's a moment in time. It's a moment in history. It's a moment when you lift the lid on something that's very secretive and in a country like Ireland. So,
because, of course, that was the point. That's the very point, Lavinia, because Ireland was a very different place in 1992. It was an extraordinary moment in time when you kind of broke down that barrier and just said, this is me. I have nothing to be ashamed of. I want you to hear my story.
Oh, look, it was so, so different, you know. And even yesterday, when I saw Ciara giving her powerful, powerful statement, and the support and the acknowledgement and the love and hope and well wishes was just, I just thought, oh, my God, this is amazing that, you know, this young woman is getting all this support, richly deserved, you know, when I go back to a time when I think, well, that wasn't there for me, you know, because you didn't talk about these things, you know, it was Catholic Ireland, you know, the rape was not on anyone's agenda. A court was where it took place and where it stayed. And, you know, it was never to be spoken about outside a court, and it was never to be acknowledged. You know, we were to make sure that the rapist was well represented and, you know, character reference, everything was in line there. But you were the one that was harming this rapist and his reputation. And that was the way it was seen back then. You know, and only for people like Gerry Ryan, who said, no, we're not going to, you know, silence these women anymore. They have a voice, they want to be heard, you know, they're going to make a huge, huge sacrifice. And that's what it is when you go public. It is a huge, huge personal sacrifice. And it's traumatic and it's scary.
Yeah, take me back to that time because, I mean, Ciara, as I mentioned there when I was introducing you, Lavinia, Ciara acknowledged that, you know, she probably wouldn't have been able to do that only for the people who had gone before her. And, you know, and as I said, you were the very first. You were only a baby yourself, were you only 19?
Oh, only a baby. A very frightened, scared, headstrong. Definitely headstrong and determined to do the right thing. And I always, I think, and even when I was having chats with Gerry after it, I would always be that of the mindset that I did not want any other person, man or woman, to go through what I went through, you know, and to do the right thing. And, you know, that's what Ciara did yesterday. She did the right thing, you know, and I wanted to do the right thing. And I was, because I felt what happened in court was the wrong thing.
And just to remind people, Lavinia, that you had your guilty verdict when you, but the sentence had been suspended.
Yeah, he was found guilty and given a 10-year sentence and suspended for a year. Oh my God, it was just so wrong. Like, because we, you know, we had to go back again and back again, and you know, and he just walked back to his life, you know, and I walked out with my world in tatters, you know. And I think it's important too, Katie, that I reference, you know, women that report rape and bring it to court and, you know, don't go public. But they, you know, and we don't see them, we don't hear them. Well, I see them and I hear them and I support them, because we must remember that we owe them, the silent people that go through these traumas, we owe them as a society a debt of gratitude, you know. And I would often reach out to, you know, Orla O'Donnell there, who's an amazing, amazing, sympathetic and compassionate journalist.
Indeed, yes. And she's a fantastic journalist. Orla O'Donnell, our RTE, our legal correspondent here. She, of course, as you say, will have met a lot of the victims and survivors down at the courts that we will never meet. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, to report a rape is just, you know, it's an incredibly difficult thing to do, because your life then is upended. To go through the steps or the doors of the four courts or whatever court it is, it's a huge trauma. Like, it is huge to go through a court case where, you know, and I'm not a legal mind, but I mean, when you step into that court, you're just overwhelmed with the amount of people, one, that are in there, and you're sat there, you know. Yes, you have support from the Rape Crisis Centre, invaluable support from them, but you are one person taking on a huge task of trying to put your life back together again by getting a guilty verdict, you know. And
just to say, and it has to be acknowledged as well, Lavinia, that your action coming out and actually, you know, bringing attention to what a rape victim goes through when you try and go through the justice system had two very important and fairly immediate outcomes, actually, that are still, you know, helping rape victims and victims of sexual violence today. It was that legislation in relation to victim impact statements and in relation to appealing lenient sentences.
Oh, I'm incredibly proud of that. I mean, I mightn't leave much behind me when I leave this earth, but to know that women are not silenced in a courtroom, you know, that's, I'm incredibly proud of it. Huge sacrifice, huge sacrifice to have your voice heard when everyone else is taken away from you. I mean, your dignity, your human right, your body, you know, your mind, your soul, everything taken away. But the one thing that you have is your voice. And, you know, I've never experienced giving a victim impact statement, but, you know, and I always worry about people that do it, because I'm thinking, my God, I hope they're okay. You know, I hope, you know, that they're able to, you know, articulate themselves. And I hope I haven't put anything, I suppose, on them, that, you know, because some people don't want to do that, you know. But I do think, and I'm very proud of it, like, you know, and I think after it came in, I suppose I always felt, you know, that people would, you know, people were not nice, were not kind, were not compassionate. And I always was made to feel that I had done the wrong thing from, you know, by leaving victim impact statements and the leniency of appeal and lenient sentence. And, you know, I'm proud of that, you know, and that's something that...
Oh, my
you
God,
know,
you so well. Should be, Levi. I mean, because I think not only has that, I am sure, helped so many people, because I know I've spoken and interviewed a lot of people who've been through this over the years, that telling their story, giving themselves that voice, letting... You know, putting that into words and being heard has made a huge
yeah.
impact on all of those survivors. But also, I think the reporting of these victim impact statements has had a massive impact in our understanding as a country of, you know, what this crime does to its victims.
And that's it, you know. And when I heard Ciara yesterday talking about, you know, rape songs and, you know, the humiliation she felt and, you know, and people not understanding what rape is, you know, and just being very flippant about it and being very cruel about it. You know, read some victim impact statements, you know, try and educate yourself. You know, I don't know if you mind me saying this, but, you know, I'm involved with the We Consent campaign. You know, for anyone that in any way wants to educate themselves, go look at links to that, you know, because rape is a life-changing event in anybody's life, you know, and you're living with it every day, you know, and I think as Ciara said, you know, you have to adjust yourself to live with that because... You know, your body is different. You don't see it the same. You don't love it the same.
Sorry to interrupt you there, but just to say, I mean, we spoke. I don't know if you remember this. I spoke to you just, it would have been maybe one or two, maybe 3 years after you had gone public. And at that stage, you were still very much struggling with
yeah.
coming to terms with what you know, with what had happened to you and how, you know, and coping with it. And I must say back then, I left your company feeling very worried about you.
Yeah. It is. Like, I think when someone is raped, Katie, you know, you do lose something. You know, and I suppose for all I went through and all many victims and survivors go through, they struggle to accept, they struggle to adjust, they struggle to trust, they struggle to love, they struggle to live. And that's, you know, and that, they are life-changing events. You struggle just to get up in the morning, you know, when that crime is committed against you, you have to walk in that same body the rest of your born days. And I suffered badly with anorexia, and there's traces of that to this day still there, you know, and I always felt if I had, I suppose, the understanding from society back then, I would have been able to kind of, and this is why I say to a lot of victims and survivors, please don't let rape become all of you. Please let it become part of you, because that's what it is, whether you like it or not, it is what it is, you know, it is part of you. And trying to find a way to make that not all of you is tough. It's very, very tough, you know. And even like for Ciara and many of us, we walk in the shadows with rape. You know, it is always like an extra organ in the body or an extra, you know, thing in the brain, you know. And I always say to people, please don't let this become all of you. The person, the rapist, is doing his sentence. He is a rapist. He has been found guilty of rape. You do not need to do the sentence along with him.
That is the message really you wanted to get out for Ciara in particular, as you say, but for everyone who is out there who have been through this.
Yeah, because it's a you know, it's people are very brave, women, men, who go through this, you know, and I suppose I'll include myself in it. We are brave people. We, you know, we have the backbone to know that we have been wronged. You know, we go through this because we want to feel and to hand guilt and shame to its owner. So when a rapist is found guilty in a court, we can walk out of that court and say, guilt and shame, I put it back on you. It's yours. I don't want it anymore. I want to be able to accept that this rape has happened to me, see what steps I can do or make it part of me, but you are not going to be all of me.
Okay. Okay, Lavinia, I'm going to have to end here. We're actually out of time. It was just fabulous having you on, and I'm sure there's people out there that will agree with this text who's just come in to me, Lavinia. Lavinia Kerwick's courage and compassion are inspiring. She defines humanity. Thank you so much, Lavinia, and take care of yourself.
And Ciara, the very best of luck going forward. You've got this now. You can do it.
Thanks.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.